stand by for action.
Gamer's Haven Special Edition.
This is Ethan with the Gamer's Haven Podcast, and you're about to listen to an interview I did with Alan Varney. Alan Varney's been in the industry for quite some time, and most people should recognize him from the 2004 Mongoose Publishing release of Paranoia XP. So he and I sat down and talked quite a bit on his career and on Paranoia. So be sure to hit our website at gamershavenpodcast.com and visit our Amazon store to see a selection of Alan Varney's products for sale there. In addition, you can also hit our forums and talk about the interview and suggest who you might want to see us or hear us, I should say, talk to. So, and that's all at gamershavenpodcast.com. Enjoy the interview. Noble Knight Games has been serving the needs of thousands of gamers worldwide since 1997. With a huge selection of over 30,000 unique products, including discounts on most in-print games of up to 50% off or more, Noble Knight Games is the place for out-of-print RPGs, board games, war games, collectible card games, miniatures, and all things game-related. They ship worldwide and will purchase or trade your titles you no longer need, new, or used. Your satisfaction is guaranteed. Just visit www.noblenight.com or visit our website for direct access to thousands of new, out-of-print, and in some cases, one-of-a-kind items. This is Ethan with the Gamers Haven Podcast, and I have the pleasure of being here with Mr. Alan Varney.
Hi there.
Alan is a longtime game designer, writer, editor. I mean, you've pretty much done everything.
I've been kind of the utility infielder in a lot of different operations. I've been a game designer since 1983. I have published three board games and a 24 role-playing game supplements and 7 books. And I imagine if anyone in the podcast audience knows me, it's probably for the 2004 edition of the classic science fiction role-playing game Paranoia, originally published in 1984 by West End Games, designed by Dan Gelber and Eric Goldberg and Greg Kostikian. I did the 2004 published by Mongoose, originally published under the name Paranoia XP, and it was pretty well received and quite successful.
And then I packaged
the support line for the next couple of years after that as well, so I was quite the Paranoia guy.
And then Microsoft threw a fit about the XP, if memory serves.
Yeah, they for some reason thought that people might be really confused if they bought Paranoia and expected a Microsoft licensed product. So, you know, we were considering other titles like Paranoia Vista Home and Professional Edition, but that didn't fly. So we just basically took off the suffix, and it's just Paranoia.
Excellent. Well, as I'm finding with the interviews that I've been doing, is there are some names that some people might not recognize, and yours might be one of them until they actually go and look at some of the books on their shelves and say, whoa, he did do that. So I really just want to ask sort of the first question I ask everyone is how did you get into gaming in general? What got you into the hobby?
I got in through the earliest publication of Steve Jackson, the American Steve Jackson. He did a micro game called Ogre, published by Metagaming, a company in Austin, Texas, now defunct. This was back in about 77 or thereabouts. Mm-hmm. They advertised on the back of Analog Science Fiction magazine, which, you know, you don't see that much nowadays. But I ordered that, and then I ordered a bunch of other micro games, got into historical board war gaming and strategy and tactics, among other things. And finally, I looked at all of these games that I'd bought, and I didn't really have anybody to play with. And so I just said, you know, I got to get the money back that I spent on all these games, you know, somehow. So I designed one, and I submitted it to Steve Jackson, who had by that time started his own company in Austin, Texas. And we went back and forth on that for a couple of years, and he finally published it. And then he published my second. And then he hired me to move out from California to Austin, Texas, here where I still am. And I became the assistant editor on his in-house gaming magazine, The Space Gamer, working under Brent Spector, who later became a legendary producer of computer games. And so I worked at C. Jackson Games for about 2.5 years, editing the magazine and doing some other game stuff. And then I went freelance and did quite a lot of work for TSR and West End and about half a dozen other companies on a bunch of different lines. And so and then along around the turn of the century or thereabouts, I started moving more into computer games and have worked freelance for various different computer game companies. Right now, in fact, I'm doing a contract for Warren Spector, whom I've worked off with off and on for, lo, these 25-plus years. I'm working on his Epic Mickey video game that he's doing for, with Disney Interactive at his studio, Junction Point Studios, here in Austin. So maybe that's a little too much of an answer for your question, but it's it's been kind of a checkered career. I'll grant you that.
No. Like I said, just looking at your bibliography on your website, alanvarney.com, just looking to see what you've all done, and it's there's quite a bit there. You've really been have had your fingers in a lot of pies in the industry.
Yeah. Well, you know, I kind of became the sort of the second line person for any new line that was starting up. They would bring in the company would have their own in-house people or their favorite outsider do the major release, and then I would be brought in to do like the second or the third release. I did the first adventure for TSR's Spelljammer campaign world, Wild Space. I did one of the earliest Paranoia modules back in '85 for West End Games, and so it's just kind of an obscure niche in the business, but it has brought me into kind of a lot of different kinds of forms and genres. I've written for science fiction games, for fantasy, for superhero games, lots of different hats worn there.
Excellent. Well, real quick, I want to touch on some of the early stuff you did. You went and you mentioned that you did some work with superheroes and work with TSR. What is it? What was your experience working with them?
For Marvel Superheroes from TSR, this is the original Marvel game from many years ago. I did the big Deluxe City campaign set, a complete description in a big box set of Manhattan as it exists in the Marvel Universe. And, you know, if you're a Marvel Comics fan, you know about half of those Marvel superhero comics are set in New York City or in the Marvel equivalent thereof. And so this was a giant travelogue of New York City. And I did quite a lot of research in all kinds of travel books and history books about New York City, but there was all kinds of stuff that I really needed to know for the superhero version of that just wasn't in the travel books, you know, like how strong you have to be to pick up the Statue of Liberty, that kind of thing. And in fact, I was writing it in the midst of the big crossover event of the Marvel Comics line that particular summer. I think it was like 1989 or 90. It was called Inferno, and it was this demonic invasion of New York City.
I remember I have pretty much all of those comics, I believe, somewhere.
And there were dozens of issues sprawling over 10 or 12 different superhero comics all set in New York City, because they were all together, you know, crossing over, fighting this massive alien invasion. Mm-hmm. And I was in the midst of writing about New York City as this invasion was taking place. And I would go down to the comic book store twice a week and just page through all the comics and say, oh, well, I have to rewrite that. And, oh, there, that has to be changed. And, oh, and that as well. it was actually kind of a funny story there in terms of Inferno and its impact on the Marvel universe, and also, as it turns out, the impact of my particular product for Marvel Superheroes on the Marvel editorial line, which I had not expected. I guess before I start the story, it's important that your listeners understand just how big Inferno was in the Marvel Comics line. They were from this for months and months in advance as the big, huge event that it was going to change the Marvel Universe forever, that it would, you know, take advantage of elements that had been established decades before, and it would be this huge sea change in the Marvel Universe, and they played it up and played it up. So it was in that context that I was reading these comics while researching my Marvel Manhattan set, the Deluxe City campaign set, and I had a contact, Dwayne McDuffie, in the Marvel Comics licensing department at that time. He later became a very noted comics writer in his own right, but at that point he was still in licensing. And so I was reading these comics every week as they came out. And I said, I called him up and I said, you know, I can't figure out exactly what's going on here. You know, the big climax had happened in some of the pages of X-Men. And I said, I can't understand. Is the invasion over and it all went back to the way it was before? Is it, is there still damage? Does everybody remember it? Does nobody remember it? And he said, I'll get back to you. And so a week went by, a couple of weeks, and my deadline was approaching, and I called him back, and I said, so what's the story on this Inferno? And he said, I want you to know that your question has provoked a major confrontation and crisis in the Marvel editorial offices, because through lack of editorial oversight, they had kind of got all these different writers on these dozens of different titles had gone off in different directions with clearly different understandings of what the consequences were going to be of this invasion. And so I said, well, you know, I need an answer. And he said, I'll get back to you. So I wait another week. The deadline is looming. And I call him back and I say, so what's the verdict? And he says, we've decided not to talk about it. And I said, what does that mean? Does that mean it was imaginary? Or does it? He said, we're just not going to talk about it. We're never going to broach the subject again. So it was a very Orwellian solution there after this gigantic buildup to just say, oh, no, don't know what you're talking about. I believe at some point there was even in the back pages of some obscure Spider-Man annual, there was some attempt to remedy or explain what had actually happened. But by then, nobody cared. And I just kind of finessed it as best I could in my set and just shipped it off to TSR. And that was the last anybody ever thought about it.
Oh, wow. That's hysterical. Oh. Is that generally the type of experience you had working with a licensed product?
Well, you know, I haven't done an awful lot of licensed work, but I will say that now I'm working on this Mickey Mouse game, which technically, you know, in the letter of the law, is not licensed because Disney Interactive owns Junction Point Studios. So, you know, it's within the house of mouse, as it were.
Sure.
But, you know, I will say that when you're dealing with a licensed product, you have a lot of supervisors, or it can potentially have quite a lot, and it can be, you know, the dynamics of the and the politics of the project become actually quite a bit more important than the actual creative effort invested in the project. So when you see a licensed project on the shelves, you are seeing the mere iceberg tip of a huge, huge collaborative undertaking. And, you know, I think it's a tribute to people's resourcefulness and resilience that there's some, you know, really good licensed projects out there.
Mm-hmm. Well, moving on from your work with the Marvel Superheroes game, as much as I love it, you also mentioned you did some stuff with just TSR and everybody's favorite RPG, you know, D&D.
You know, I'm sorry, Ethan, but I think we're having some Skype connection problems here. I wonder if I could get you to repeat that.
No problem. You were talking about TSR, and you also mentioned you did some work with the Dungeons & Dragons line.
Yes, I was. I did my very first work for TSR was for the basic D&D line, the non-advanced Dungeons and Dragons. This was for the Masters set for high level characters called Five Coins for a Kingdom, a module that that kind of assumed that characters of levels 28 to 32 could pretty much do everything. And so I ended up in the climax of that adventure throwing them in the center of the sun. And it was not some bogus fantasy sun either. It was the sun, 25,000 degrees Celsius, you know, and you can just about make them sweat when you throw them into the center of the sun. And so, and from there, I just kind of tried to see what else I could get away with now and then. I the Spelljammer module was pretty good in that it was set out in fantasy space, which is the Spelljammer setting, outer space in the fantasy universe. And
sure.
So I had this gigantic planet-sized artifact, or I should say asteroid-sized artifact, that was created by a long-head super race of beholders, the monster, you know. And so it turned out that they had hollowed out, in the creation of this artifact, they had hollowed out this asteroid, so it was this gigantic dungeon of 12 rooms, but each room was a cubic mile across. So basically you could take your fantasy spelljamming ship and sail it right through the dungeon and into all these different rooms, which they were their own self-contained world environments. So I like to call that the largest dungeon that TSR ever published, even though, I mean, in terms of area, if nothing else, even though it only had 12 rooms. And yeah, I mean, what I liked there was the sense of scope and of grandeur. And yet, you know, you can go in completely different directions with D&D. And I also wrote a lot for the Dark Sun setting, which was the AD&D setting that was set on this desert planet of Apis.
Right.
Very hard scrabble kind of existence where you just had to be tough because each and every monster out there in the wilderness wanted to kill you personally. Mm-hmm. So it was very much a kind of a freebooting sword and sorcery Conan-esque sort of world. And, you know, I did some stories set in that world, and I did the Veiled Alliance campaign supplement about the big secret society. You know, I'm kind of rambling at this point because it was an awful lot of work, a lot of different projects there. I did the Hollow World adventures, the first trilogy of Hollow World adventures for the D&D Hollow World campaign set designed by my friend Aaron Alston.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's that kind of takes you all rambling all over this gigantic, hollow sphere, encountering, you know, a dozen different cultures. So, you know, all of this is just by way of leading to different interesting things to research. Oh, I'm going to mm-hmm. find out about the ancient Aztecs, and here's, you know, my research onto, you know, ancient Egyptian pyramid architecture and this kind of stuff. So, I really took great delight in all of that.
Now, when you were doing work for TSR, were you on staff there, or were you a freelancer at the time?
I was not on staff. I was freelance. I had gone freelance in 1986, and actually never looked back. I have to say that I believe freelance is the only way to live. And, you know, increasingly, I think society is sort of catching up to that idea because it's getting to, you know, entrepreneurial spirit is about all that's going to carry us forward through these tough times.
Sure.
And so, you know, being independent and being able to fare for yourself and fend for yourself is, it's a skill to be learned. And there are certainly pitfalls along the way. And, you know, I lived for 10 or 12 years freelancing in the game business, which is a non-trivial accomplishment, I must tell you.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And yet, you know, it was invigorating. I mean, you have to have a certain propensity to hustle. You know, you've got to be able to give good value on a very tight schedule at times. And you know, at that time, I was enormously prolific. I did my first 1.5 million words in that freelancing time, just trying to, you know, keep my head above water. And it was exciting. I kind of look back on it with a certain fondness.
Excellent. Now, you mentioned you also did a few board games. I want to just real quick ask you about one you did with TSR called Gamma Rotters.
Yeah, Gamma Riders was a somewhat ill-advised attempt to broaden their Gamma World property. Mm-hmm. They had decided at TSR that they wanted to try to turn this into a, I don't know what they hope to do with it, maybe turn it into a cartoon series, probably a multimedia property in every form they could possibly flog it. And their brainstorm there was to have giant monsters,
yes,
Godzilla-type monsters. And so they commissioned me to do this board game that kind of plays like Cosmic Encounter or the old Dune board game a little bit.
The main reason I ask is because I have a copy sitting on my shelf.
Not many do, and I have to say it was
with
not
the
well
expansion,
received.
Mind you, with the expansion. So
yeah, it was great to be able to name the giant space hamster and the giant hamster Dweemish the Hamsterian, and you know it was all very tongue in cheek, and it was the adjective. Was Wahoo. They wanted it to be a Wahoo game. Well, you know, I suppose I did the best I could with that. But after I turned in the design, in editorial development, they decided to readjust the mix of the deck of cards and the various effects that were there. So, you know, there's many a slip twixt the cup and the post-Holocaust landscape.
All right. Real quick on that is, how do you approach, because since you've done, you know, board games and RPGs and some even some card games, it looks like, how do you approach the different design aspects of that?
Well, you know, I have an approach to design that I've never heard any other designer, never met another designer who goes at it quite the way I do. I rely very much on a psychological approach. The first question I ask is, how do I want the player to feel at particular circumstances or points in the game? How do I bring about a particular psychological effect? And then I kind of design backwards from that. And I've never met anyone else who does it quite that way. It has served me very well, in particular, with the Paranoia line. Paranoia is a very unusual role-playing game. And maybe I should take a little time out just to explain the premise of Paranoia for your listeners who might not know about it. It's set in an underground city of the future, ruled by an insane computer. And all the players are troubleshooters in service to the computer. And they are charged with rooting out traitors, who include members of secret societies and mutants. But the trouble is that, unbeknownst to all the other players, each player is himself both a mutant and a member of a secret society, and thus a traitor. And so every player is trying to get evidence on all the other players and get them accused and terminated before they do the same to him. So it's this very lighthearted, satirical game of backstabbing and high spirits that pretty much set the role-playing field on its ear back when it appeared in 1984. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't really fit in categories of what kind of game it is. You know, you look into role-playing theory like on The Forge, and you hear about gamist and narrativist and simulationist theoretical approaches, and Paranoia doesn't really fit in any of those. It's just its own thing. It has been a very, very remarkable game through its entire history. And so it was that psychological angle that I think served me well with Paranoia in particular, because it's so much a psychological exercise. And so in my redesign of the 2004 edition, just to show you what I'm talking about here, I came up with this idea in the system in the game called Perversity Points. And these are points that seem to serve, on the surface, much the same function as the hero points or fate points in other games. That they're they're points that you can spend to influence the die roll. But as a matter of fact, in Paranoia, your perversity points you can spend to influence other players' die rolls, in particular to worsen their chance of success. And it is amazing how the spending of perversity points can foment rivalries and resentments and, you know, just and the urge toward revenge. And I thought that was quite the most successful system I introduced into that edition. because it furthered all the goals of the game, which is, you know, Paranoia is not really a role-playing game in the sense that you're not actually trying to assume a personality. You're not trying to project yourself into a role like an actor as you would in many other role-playing games. Rather, what you want is that you as Game Master in Paranoia want the players sitting there at the table with the character sheets and the pencils and the munchies. You want them to feel paranoid and resentful and suspicious and mistrustful right there in their own skins. And so it was a constant focus on how do you get the players to resent each other. And, you know, that leads you into design territory that you don't often see in other role-playing games.
Yeah.
And that's where a psychological approach helped quite a lot.
Excellent. Now, Paranoia, obviously, it's the thing people are probably going to recognize your name for, and I know it's what brought me to find you was Paranoia XP. Could you tell us a little bit how the new edition basically took shape? How did it how did that come about from Mongoose?
Well, the new edition of Paranoia was an unusually rich and exciting design experience for me. Mongoose Publishing approached me with a pretty tight deadline. This was, I guess I should set up first, that the original designers of the game, Dan Gelber, Eric Goldberg, and Greg Kostikian, had recovered the rights to Paranoia after the game had been out of print for almost 10 years.
Right.
The game had suffered a very sad decline in its the last half of its reign at West End Games. It had started out quite well under its original brilliant line editor, Ken Ralston, who made it famous and made it a bestseller. But then after Ken left and a few others had had their way with it, then just into the hands of people who really did not understand the game at all and furthermore had no sense of humor. It was just sad to watch that game decline under their mishandling. Every product that came out in the late 80s, early 90s, I said to myself, well, you know, this is the bottom. It can't possibly get any worse than this. And yet, every new one was this new misadventure. So it finally went out of print in 1993. And after West End entered bankruptcy, the original designers recovered rights to it. And so they were looking around for a new designer in 2004. They gave Mongoose a list of acceptable designers, and Mongoose went down everyone on the list, and finally, and nobody would do it, and finally, in desperation, they turned to me, the last name on the list, and I was available. So that's how I got to do that. But the very first motive for me and, in fact, for the entire Paranoia fan community, which had kept the game's memory alive through long, dry spells, was to remedy and to eradicate the memory of that sad decline. And so there was a very active bulletin board, fan community, forum community, ParanoiaLive.net. And so I hooked up with those, the administrator there, and the staff, and the whole community, and basically kind of what amounted to open sourcing the design. I would circulate all the playtest drafts. I would air new subsystem ideas. I would ask for input from everybody on, you know, what new skills, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and I made it very clear. Greg Kostikian and I were very Greg Kostikian established this sort of disclaimer and claim of rights that it was quite funny. You can see it on the Paranoia blog. If you go to paranoia.kostik.com, this disclaimer at the bottom of the blog page will tell you exactly what was going on there. And when he said that, well, in fact, I happen to be right here at the web. I can read it to you. All your rights belong to us. No bloody Creative Commons here. Blah, ha, ha. No, seriously. If you make non-commercial use of stuff here, that's fine. But we reserve all commercial rights and all rights for derivative material and derivative works therefrom and paranoia, supplementary products, licensed products, without any compensation whatever for all time to come and throughout this universe and any alternate universes that may be discovered, you know, in rights that are specifically but not exclusively including the microbrewery, beer, ale, and porter, salty and sugary snack, and tattoo design rights deriving therefrom. So they knew, the fans for this game knew straight up front, well, you know, we're not going to pay you anything and you're not going to be able to keep the rights, and yet they still responded with their eyes wide open. They responded brilliantly to the design requirements and to the requests. They provided huge amounts of new material because they knew that it would improve the game they loved. And we were all working on it in exactly that same attitude, to just bring this game back to what. And without them, I never could have made that deadline. It came out in Origins of 2004 and was a huge success. And about a dozen of those ParanoiaLive.net contributors I recruited as a sort of stable to write the game support line. And the first dozen products were all written by them in a group that we called the Traitor Recycling Studio. So it was the most enthralling creative process I've had in my entire experience in the gaming industry, and I would love to work that way again. You know, that sort of rich, intense collaboration.
That's actually sounds amazing. Wow.
Yeah.
And anyone who listens to our show knows none of us are huge fans of Mongoose, but we are all big fans of Paranoia, and we do have copies of that. So,
well, you know, if you look at the RPG.net gaming index, mm-hmm. you'll see that Paranoia is quite the highest rated product in the Mongoose line. It's in the top 10 or top 25 of core rule systems, and I think it's actually in the top 25 of all mm-hmm. their 13,000 products or so.
Oh, yeah. And you worked on that, you basically worked on that line for 2 years. Was that it? Are you not working
That's
on it anymore?
Right. Well, you know, I kind of like to keep my hand in. After I left the line, it passed to Mongoose staff writer Gareth Hanrahan, very, very talented Irish guy. Who was just this wunderkind who could produce thousands and thousands of words indefinitely in Alpha Complex. And it was not only fun and funny, it was playable. And he was just a great treasure of this line. And so under Mongoose's contractual obligation with the Paranoia licensors, they had to do 4 books a year. And so mm-hmm. Gareth wrote all 4 of those books a year himself, and I kind of, you know, would look at the manuscripts. He was kind enough to run them by me, and I would kind of, you know, throw in bits here and there. But largely, it was him kind of carrying forward, soldiering on all by himself, and it was just amazing to see. So then, this past year, 2009, was the Paranoia 25th anniversary.
Mm-hmm.
And so in order to celebrate that, Mongoose decided to reissue Paranoia in 3 new rule books. They were not a new edition. They're largely compatible with the existing edition that I did in 2004,
mm-hmm.
but they were broken up by security clearance. Now, in Alpha Complex, the setting of the game, there is a very rigid, unbreakable system of security clearances that show how much the computer trusts you. And the higher your clearance, the more it trusts you, and the more perks that come your way, and the more power you exercise. So every clearance is color-coded along the colors of the rainbow, from red, which is low, to violet, which is high, and then above that is the almighty ultraviolet, or high programmer. They're the ones who wear white. So now the 3 rule books of the Paranoia system cover 3 different ranges of the security clearance system that have different characters and characteristics. So the basic one is the Paranoia Troubleshooters, which covers the low red clearance troubleshooter adventures, pretty much the classic adventures that everybody remembers for Paranoia.
Right.
Then there is also Internal Security, which covers green and blue clearance, sort of the mid-range. That's the range where you really start to have a certain amount of power. And if you're a longtime fan of Paranoia, you'll remember that West End did a campaign supplement called Hill Sector Blues. Well, Gareth took some of that and then added a huge amount of new material to flesh out the life of the blue clearance character. And then, lastly, just coming out, I believe this coming month, is High Programmers, which is, God help us, playing ultraviolet clearance High Programmers as player characters, a whole band of them together.
That is terrifying.
That one is different in that, that one is going to, we're going to have to see how that one works out, because this one is a completely new rule system. High Programmers is not compatible with other games in the series. It's a completely different rule system that kind of partakes very much of the old Amber Diceless role-playing by the late Eric Wujek, or Nobilis. By Rebecca Borgstrom. And it's got this unusual auction system, and basically a high programmer will never sully himself to actually take part in any mission himself. Rather, he deploys this vast army of minions, and it is the deploying of minions that marks your success or failure in the high programmer game, because, you know, they never do exactly what you tell them to do.
Oh, and
they
of course not.
Own ideas, and you know what you're trying to do is accumulate a kind of a currency called access, which has a minor part in the other two Paranoia games, but here becomes this all-consuming currency. High programmers want access points above all else, and for every crisis, the computer allocates a certain budget of access points, and so all these high programmers are squabbling and fighting over who gets how the access points, and they use the access points to buy new minions and to make things happen. And, you know, ideally they want to kind of tuck away a little extra something of access for their own use, and how well they do that depends on how well they play. So right. High Programmers is going to be a whole new direction for Paranoia, and it's going to have its own support products as well.
Excellent. Now, you mentioned how Paranoia sort of was had its decline in the late 80s and the early 90s, and then obviously it was revived in 04. How or why do you think that Paranoia keeps soldiering on after 25 years?
Well, it does things that no other game does. No other game does quite as well, and in particular, it is the benchmark for humor in role playing games. You know, one of the earliest supplements for the new line was a reprint collection of some of the best of the early West End line, which we gathered together in a hardcover mission compilation called Flashbacks.
Right.
And this included some of those great early ones like John Ford, the Yellow Clearance, Black Box, Blues.
Which was an award winner, if memory serves.
Yes, and it was a huge, huge success. And Vapors Don't Shoot Back by Curtis Smith, and the various others. And, of course, the one that everybody always remembers, longtime Paranoia fans will cite this over and over as the game's quintessential moment, Me and My Shadow Mark IV. By Stephen Crane and Peter Corliss, which appeared in Acute Paranoia back in 1985, where the troubleshooters are sent to guard this gigantic intelligent cyber tank. and they are, you know, they're basically like insects compared to this mighty thing, and yet the computer in its wisdom has decided that they are supposed to guard this thing. And while they are standing guard over this incredibly valuable new research and development breakthrough, everybody and his mother in Alpha Complex comes by and tries to sabotage this damn tank. And the one moment that everyone always remembers that will send every Paranoia fan immediately into this sort of wild gesticulation of explaining what happened when they were in this mission and this happened is the chapter called Something Falls Off. And the episode summary of that chapter is Something Falls Off. You know, basically, something falls off the tank and it all goes haywire, and you have to kind of figure out, well, are we going to fix this? Are we going to run for the hills? You know, are we going to, how do we go about that? And just the permutations of different outcomes that people have managed to wring from this one simple situation of something falling off the tank is is one of the great validations of Paranoia as a unique game. And it's the kind of game that people will tell you incessantly about the great things that happen. And what was interesting to me during the design process in 2004 is that these players, when they were recounting what happened, their favorite moments from their games, it was never, ever once about, boy, my guy was really strong, or he was really fast, or anything like that. It was never about the character. It was always about, here's how I got the guy sitting next to me at the table, or here's how he got me, or, you know, we were in an elevator and the lights went out, and there was this shot, and then the lights came back on, and one of us was lying dead on the bottom of the elevator, and then the elevator got to its floor, and the door slid open, and we all just walked away. You know, this is the kind of story that people will tell over and over and over in Paranoia, because it isn't important what your character can do. It's important what you are feeling and doing to your other players. And it was a real interesting design revelation for me, is that fundamentally you just didn't want to have them play a role. You just wanted them to identify in their own person with what was going on. And so as a result, there's very little in the way of, like, demeanor and nature and all of that stuff that you'll get in a White Wolf game, which, you know, I love fine for a White Wolf game, but for Paranoia, it just didn't work at all. At least I don't think it needs to be there. So that's why, if you look at these theory frameworks that talk about, well, is it gamist or narrativist or simulationist, you know, you really can't quite get your handle on it, get your hands on it, because it's this sort of mercurial thing. It's magical in its way, and that is what has kept the flame alive through all these decades.
Amen to that. Now, real quick, did you guys ever update what was it? The Computer Always Shoots Twice.
That was a compilation that West End did in the late 80s that reprinted two adventures. One was Orc Busters by Ken Rolfe, parody of D&D, and the other was my own Send in the Clones, my first Paranoia adventure that I wrote in collaboration with Warren Spector. And so both of those were reprinted in the Flashbacks volume. Send in the Clones in the very first one, where I finally got it printed the way I wrote it, thank God. You know, it was all worthwhile because of that, if nothing else. And then Orc Busters appeared in Flashbacks 2, which came out the following year.
So just to clear it with our listeners, they're not just straight reprints, obviously.
These are all updated to new edition. They all have characters with entirely new skill sets. And,
excellent.
Yeah, and, you know, there's very little tweaking that actually needed to take place, because...
Sure.
So little of the rules are important in Paranoia. Paranoia is unique in that it assigns total power and authority to the game master and makes a point of smearing the players' faces in that. I mean, it just says the game master is always right. And, you know, no other game will go quite that bold and or cheesy, depending on what your attitude is. But it works very much in Paranoia. And so because of that, we didn't find that we had to update an awful lot of the old adventures. We just kind of tweaked the rules and did some cosmetic changes, and it all worked fine.
Well, sadly, moving on from Paranoia, it's not the only thing that you've done. You've also done some novels, haven't you?
I did an Earth Dawn novel, a licensed Earth Dawn novel for FASS's Earth Dawn fantasy role-playing game back in 94. And interestingly, it was never published in English. It was only published in a German translation.
Oh, wow.
they killed the line shortly after my novel was turned in. And then I did the very first Dragon Dice novel for TSR's Dragon Dice game. That was a sort of a collectible dice game that was in TSR's last years in the early 90s. And, you know, you might well say, well, how do you write a novel about dice? And I'm not actually sure that I had a good answer to that, because the novel did not turn out real well. But, you know, it's one of those cases where, once again, they kind of brought me in after the main guys had set things up. They kind of turned to me for the second project. And so I did the first novel as one of the early spin-off projects for that line. And beyond that, I have experimented with fiction, and you know, I just after all these years without much success, I'm kind of thinking that I'm not really cut out for it, and yet I feel still drawn to it. I'm very attracted by the current tumult and transformation in the publishing business, and you know, it's he has an opinion about it, and nobody knows how it's all going to shake out. But you know, I'm starting to feel like there's going to be, or perhaps already is, a worthwhile market and a worthwhile means to find a sympathetic audience for good work in some new platform, whether it's the Kindle or the iBook or various e-books, you know, and the iPad, I should say. And so I'm kind of looking to see whether it's going to be possible to set up some kind of big collaborative arrangement to produce fiction in the same way that we had originally produced the Paranoia role-playing game.
Sure.
You know, try to organize this bunch of interested parties that would just kind of throw in as they see fit and to the interest to the level of interest that their interest to the level of involvement that their interest dictates.
Sure.
And see whether we can, you know, kind of push some sort of fiction project forward. It's still kind of, you know, inchoate in my mind. It's still kind of formless, and I'm not exactly sure what will happen with that. There's so many ways to collaborate on the web now, so many new ways like Google Wave, et cetera, that,
right.
You know, I feel like there's going to be something out there that just calls to me or that I can use to call to others and say, hey, let's tell stories. And that, I think, might work out better for me as a, sort of an editor and mastermind than as, you know, the sole creator, where typically I just tend to lose focus and, you know, become this mouse potato. I just surf the web all day instead of writing. So, you know, with a collaborator or a group of them, I feel like you know, it could be the beginning of something new. And you know, I think a lot of people are going to be beginning something new because otherwise they're not going to have a career. That's the time that we're heading into.
Now, speaking of collaborators, I think you mentioned it earlier, but your Trader Recycling.
Yeah, the Trader Recycling Studio was this sort of informal band of like-minded paranoia writers. I had run this this online game called a Lexicon game. It was sort of a, I guess you could call it a role-playing game in the sense that all the players pretended to be writers collaboratively producing this kind of report for the computer, the report called the Toothpaste Disaster. And you can, in fact, find that on my website at paranoia.alanvarney.com. And this was based on a design by Neil Krishnaswamy. And there have been several Lexicon games run through the web, and it's pretty much the ideal platform for that. And over the course of a couple of months, these writers would submit entries for this putative you know, report twice a week for a couple of months. And so in the course of that time, I used that to kind of spot the ones who really got paranoia. And that is a very rare quality. Some of the best writers in the role-playing business have nonetheless demonstrated that they just really don't quite get paranoia. It is it is a completely different skill set from just being a good writer. And so it is far more important in my mind to get the setting and to get the atmosphere than it is a slick professional writer. And so I found a lot of writers through there that had never published a word before. And I brought them in and recruited them to produce the first dozen supplements in the line, and by gosh, they came through like champs, I have to say.
Yes, yes, they did. And what exactly is Ninjalistics?
Well, after the Trader Recycling Studio kind of went away, or at least I should say after we left the Paranoia line, I was thinking to myself, well, you know, I wish I could continue to work with these folks. And so we started, I worked with one of the traders, a fellow named Greg Ingber, who had this terrific idea for corporate ninjas. And the idea would be, you know, this is a contract assassination firm, except it was all very corporate and bureaucratic, and they had to fill out requisitions for all their throwing stars and all this kind of stuff. It was very much in the same satiric vein as Paranoia, and I was hoping that I would be able to recruit much the same bunch to produce material for a website, ninjalistics.com. And eventually there were going to be radio play of interesting stuff. But as it happens, I started it about a little over a year ago, and then I swear the week after I started it, everybody vanished. Greg Ingber left to become a professional poker player in Las Vegas. I mean, what kind of turn of events is that? And then the others, all, you know, they had kids or they got jobs or basically they just couldn't be involved anymore. And so I kept it going for about 6 or 7 months on my own and just thought, well, you know, I'm not actually having a whole lot of fun here by myself. So I've kind of let it lapse. I mean, I still have the website up and So that was an abortive measure, but it did teach me a lot about web design. And so my next hope is to be moving into more into web design, doing some web browser based games. I write a lot for an online gaming magazine called The Escapist, escapistmagazine.com. I've written over 70 articles for them, a lot about computer games, but quite a few about of the tabletop role-playing hobby. I've done profiles of great game designers like Greg Stafford and Paul Jakeways and Mark Miller, and my most recent one is an interview with Larry DiTilio, who wrote the Call of Cthulhu campaign, Masks of Nyarlathotep. So, you know, in that capacity, writing all these articles, I've been seeing quite a lot of vigor and activity in the browser-based gaming field that really reminds me of the very early days of tabletop role-playing. And so I'm hoping that I can get involved in that and kind of be take part in that much in the same way I was back in the 80s, taking part in the golden age of role-playing.
Sure, sure. Well, just to have an eye on wrapping things up here soon, is there any kind of a dream project you'd love to work for out there?
Man, you know, I have been so intrigued by the indie role-playing efforts now. I mean, it's there's so much vigor. It's really kind of a golden age of tabletop role-playing game design. I mean, everybody's heard of Dogs in the Vineyard and Sorcerer and My Life with Master, but you know, if you look at some of the stuff that's being published now just on people's tiny little sites or through Indie Press Revolution or Drive-Thru RPG, there's just so many things that just kind of turn my head around on my neck, like Linda Blair and The Exorcist, and you just say, wow, I didn't even know role-playing games could do that. A fellow named John Harper at 1-7 Studios, he's got a blog called The Mighty Atom, and he does these amazing little tiny role-playing games on a sheet of paper that they seem to be as much poems as they are games. And, you know, that's the sort of thing that I look at that and say, well, geez, I'd like to have a shot at that too. And, you know, that's one of those things that I may get to. And I don't know that there's anything in the larger established role-playing line that I'd like to get involved with right now. It seems like that is, to put it kindly, a very stalled right now, not to say stagnant. And so, you know, I'm not sure there's an awful lot that excites me.
Sure.
I'm glad to see that Pelgrane Press, which is a small company based in London, run by Simon Rogers, is continuing to do good work. I was kind of in a minor editorial role and did the layout on their licensed Dying Earth role-playing game, based on the Jack Vance Dying Earth fantasy stories. And although I said earlier that a licensed project has an awful lot of hands in it, that one was actually a very seamless and straightforward project with a terrific rule set by Robin Laws. And it was so nice to see that game turn out so well. And now, after the Dying Earth license lapsed, they decided that they're going to turn the rule system into another new game called Skullduggery, which uses the same kind of approach as the Dying Earth, which is that all the interesting stuff happens in these sort of con games that you play on each other as opposed to in, and makes it very much a game of interpersonal relationships. And they're going to be adapting that to a wide variety of fields. I think just the same way that they've taken their licensed Trail of Cthulhu game and adapted Gumshoe system, I should say, and adapted it to Cthulhu and to Mutant City Blues and some other stuff as well. Pelgrane, I think, is doing a lot of interesting stuff, and I guess that's what I find one of the most intriguing spots in the role-playing field now.
Yeah, we're all actually we've spoken with Pelgrane Press a few times on the show, mainly Ken Height and Robin Laws, and they are a fabulous talent. We're big fans of Robin Laws' Feng Shui game. So
I wrote one of the earliest adventures for Feng Shui. This may kind of sound familiar by now, or Feng Shui. I did one for Daedalus called Marked, appeared in a book called Marked for Death.
Yep, I've got that on my shelf.
Yeah, and I did the final adventure in that book called Shaolin Heartbreak. It's great in that it's a fight between a bunch of 18th century monks that takes place on runway 1 of Kai Tak International Airport in Hong Kong. And
I've run that adventure. So
okay, you know, I loved that that setting. And
All I can say is they managed to barrel roll the plane before it took off on the runway. So
well, okay,
only in feng shui, you know. So oh man. Now, is there anything you're currently working on for the RPG industry that you could talk about?
Well, I've been continuing to write more for The Escapist. My most recent article was about Batman. I did an article about all the kinds of things that Batman fans really can't afford to think about.
Right.
You know, like, for example, you know, here's Bruce Wayne, who's going to all these high-posh charity balls, and he's going around and making idle small talk with everybody. So one is convinced that he's a complete airhead. You know, he's like Paris Hilton. And, you know, which, when you think about it, it's a brilliant disguise, because would you believe that Paris Hilton fights crime? Really. But when you think about that too much, you realize that, well, how is he figuring out what to chat about in this idle way? And the answer has to be that he's studying it, that he's got some clipping service that provides him all kinds of clippings of recent current events that he's browsing through quickly in the limousine as Alfred drives him to the charity ball. And so here's Bruce Wayne as part of his holy war against Gotham's villains, that, you know, he has to study Jay Leno and American Idol, and he has to know what's going on at the Oscars. And, you know, if you picture Batman diligently sitting down in Batcave, just trying hard to memorize this month's Playboy party jokes, you know, you really can't think about that too long. And so this whole article, Batmanalyzed, which appeared in The Escapist issue 239 about a month ago, was all about that kind of stuff. And I'm continuing to write that kind of stuff for them going forward as well.
Excellent, excellent. Now, is there anything right now that you are currently playing or currently running or anything like that?
No, I'm afraid my life is taken up by Mickey Mouse and various escapist deadlines as well. So I wish I had more to tell you there, but I will say that I have enjoyed the new Fantasy Flight edition of Cosmic Encounter, which is my all-time favorite game.
Excellent.
Cosmic Encounter, a terrific game that I've been playing since 1977, I think. And this Fantasy Flight edition, of all of the many editions that game has been through, is quite the best. And there's just now coming out a new expansion, Cosmic Incursion, and I'm even now going to be heading to the store pretty soon to get that one. So that's my gesture toward game geekery for tonight.
So we all have a lot of Fantasy Flight stuff. we have a lot of Fantasy Flight stuff. Although I must hang my head in geek shame and say I've never played Cosmic Encounter. So
well, I recommend it highly.
It's on the list now. Maybe I'll catch it at Gen Con.
Okay.
Well, I want to thank you so much for taking the time out to talk to us. It's been a genuine pleasure picking your brain on all things in gaming you've done, especially Paranoia. So. Listening to the Gamers Haven Podcast. Subscribe to the show by visiting our website at gamershavenpodcast.com, where you can also discuss all things gaming in our forum, drop us an email, or just peruse our episode archives. You can also call us toll-free and leave a message to be played on the show by dialing 1-877-416-1270. That's toll-free, 877-416-1270. On our website, you'll also find our actual play podcasts chronicling our misadventures through all things role-playing. Enjoy what you hear? Why not support the Gamers Haven by purchasing Gamers Haven merchandise, visiting our affiliates, or just by clicking on our donate button? The Gamers Haven podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial, Share Alike 3.0 United States license, some rights reserved. Some music in this podcast is used with permission of Joe Hero Band at joehero.com. This is a Thousand Monkeys production.
This concludes the broadcast from World Control.